Welcome to the Trisexuals, a podcast about spreading your legs and opening your mind. Please be advised that you must be over 18 years of age to ride. Remember that the Trisexuals cover adult themes and concepts and oftentimes use salty language.
The fucking fucktards from fucking hell.
For your safety and the safety of others, please keep your hands in your pants at all times. Enjoy the ride.
Stop hitting me!
Every time you get it wrong, you get hit with a dildo.
Have a sex toy, we'll try it. Have a fetish, we'll try it. We masturbate and copulate to recreate and educate. We are the Trisexuals.
Hello, sexplorers. Welcome to the Trisexuals. I'm Max Chameleon.
I'm Lily Chameleon.
And I'm Kit.
Well, sexplorers, I hope you've been enjoying our really quick quickies that have been coming out. I've been having a lot of fun getting more content out there, hearing a lot more from you guys. I'm absolutely loving it. We also just released a brand new quiz on the ovipositor. And if you remember, the ovipositor was the subject of our first episode. If you haven't heard that, go back and listen to it. You can get it on our website, of course. Take the quiz. It's a lot of fun. I ended up getting the bed bug. What did you get, Lily?
I got the glorp.
The glorp. You know, I happen to know that Lone Wolf got the glorp when he took the quiz, and he's, of course, the creator of the ovipositor toys. It is a company, Primal Hardware. Kit, what did you end up getting?
I also got the bed bug.
Ah, that's right, another bed bug. Be sure to take the quiz, you know, share it with your friends, and I bet if you take it, you'll get a real kick out of the questions. I had a lot of fun writing it. So, guys, what have you been playing with? How about, let's start with Kit today.
Well, I got a really fun package in the mail from Primal Hardware, and it just times out perfectly to talk about our ovipositors, because in that fun package was a squick, which I am so excited about. So, the squick is actually smaller than the other ovipositors, like the bed bug and other things. So it's like the perfect size for me, and it has texture all along the shaft, which I am really excited about. And this one glows in the dark. So like Lone Wolf really, he knew exactly what I wanted. And here's really the kicker. So a lot of times I am lazy. I don't think ahead enough to make eggs, you know, up ahead. Sometimes I do, but sometimes I'm just like, oh, I really want to play with a toy. No eggs. So I use some glass Benoit balls that I've had forever that really are too light to be good for anything else, but they're great eggs. They're a perfect size. Well, I pulled them out and I've got this one with this great little blown glass flower in the middle. It's blue. And I pulled it out and I looked, I'm like, it matches the base of the squick. I have matching eggs for my squick. And I was so excited. So I'll have to put a picture in the show notes for you guys.
That's
but
awesome.
Yeah. I was pretty stoked. So that's what I've been up to.
You know, Zell, that's funny that you've been getting back into the ovipositors because I've been getting back into using my Kribera. It all happened because a good friend of mine, Kronos Toys, actually has access to the small egg mold. And if you remember back from my review when I was reviewing these toys, the big egg molds were just a little bit too big for my pansy pooper. So, I tried out these smaller round ones with my Kribera ovipositor, and oh my God, they work so much better. The perfect size for me. What's kind of cool is I can get a whole bunch of them in at once without them melting or anything like that. The big ones would take me a while to get in. It would end up melting by the time that, I could get like one or two in. But now I can have like a whole bunch of them, and it's like this fun, different experience, and it feels really cool. So I've been having a lot of fun with that. Lily, what have you been up to lately?
I have been playing with myself, actually.
nothing like the classics.
Yeah, that and my Magic Massager 2.0. Nothing too intense.
That's usually your go-to. You got to keep that one charging at all times.
Yeah, and then, let's see. But other than that, a couple things that I'll be talking on our next quickie is going to be taking a pole class that is actually the Triple X, which is more of a sexual, explorative pole, kind of like pole dancing, floor work, more sexy. So I'll be talking about that in the next podcast, as well as I'm going to be scheduling my first ever Brazilian wax.
Ooh, that'll be exciting.
So we'll look forward to talking about that in the next podcast.
It'll be fun if we did a live recording of your Brazilian wax so you get your reaction and everything.
But wait a minute, aren't you supposed to be doing this at the same time as me there, Max?
Wait, am I getting a Brazilian?
Yes, you're supposed to be coming with me to do it too.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, folks. We'll see you some other time. I don't know about that. I'm worried my dick would come off with it.
No, they don't do your dick, sweetie.
Well, I
they're
going to
be doing here.
Yeah, but I have hair on my shaft, and don't do they not wax the balls? I would hope not, because I think that would like be bad.
I have no idea.
Oh God, things I'm going to have to look into. I should probably know this. Anyway, enough of that fantastic visual image for everyone out there. We actually have something really awesome planned today, and I believe this is going to be a full-length episode, so enjoy that. You know, the quickies are fun and everything, but sometimes it's good to have that, you know, nice, you know, some girth to the episode.
See, I'm a girl. I love the girth.
You love the girth. Well, we have lots of girth today, because today we're talking to Tim Murray from Kink in the Cure, and he's got a lot of cool things to say about that. So let's go to that. Joining us today is Tim Murray, who is a conscious kink practitioner and author of A Kink in the Cure. By day, he spends his time consulting with businesses on cultural and disruptive transformation initiatives, coaching leaders in the pursuit of their goals, and mediating conflict in relationships. By night, he advances the evolution of society through supporting local nonprofits and engaging with subversive social change organizations. Tim, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute privilege to be here.
Whoop, whoop.
Thank you for the enthusiastic whoop whoops, Willie.
Did you call her Willie?
I call her Willie. Well, she's waving a Willie around. So, you know,
A lily with a willie.
Lily's got a willie.
That is, I'm going to be in my bunk.
I'm really excited by what you're doing. I'm kind of curious to hear you talk a little more, Tim, about how you got started and what sort of got this project going, because it was really, really neat.
Yeah, happy to. So I was on the board of directors for the Center for Sex Positive Culture in Seattle. While there, I ended up, you know, just kind of falling into doing a lot of play in the kink scene. And I had a young woman come to me and ask me if I could help recreate her rape. And this was not the first time I've had someone talk to me about doing rape play, which is, you know, its own kind of controversial thing within the kink community. But this was a clear direct request to do something specific, because she wanted me to help her reprogram the way that she thought about the experiences that she had. She wasn't really able to be around men in any kind of intimate way. And she was like, I want to do something fun and sexy around this thing I have in my head, so that when I think about this and I think about those things, I'm not triggered and afraid and scared and angry, but you know, I want to turn it around and turn the tables and have the same situation, but then I want to, like, you know, fuck the shit out of you and be able to have this really great memory associated with it. And I had done, you know, some simple play, like people that were scared of knives and then kind of helping them deal with their phobias, like doing scenes where they were holding knives in their mouth and then they kept the knife afterward. Mm-hmm. And so they had these positive associations with it. And so kind of low level stuff at that area. But when she asked me for that, I was like, oh, I think maybe I need to go to school. I think maybe if I'm going to take on that level of mental cognitive reprogramming, I should probably have some real education behind it before I start taking that on. So I wrote up the idea and submitted it to Goddard College, and they accepted the program. And so I spent the next several years researching various types of cognitive therapy. How do people approach mental health at this current day and age? What are new research around somatic, you know, experiential therapy? How does equine therapy and art therapy work? And then just kind of look at all of those things. And then I started creating this idea of conscious kink, of therapeutic kink, not just as something that happens, but as something that people can do.
Oh, I mean, that's incredibly powerful. And it, what kind of comes to my mind when you talk about like you know, having that scene happen again and doing it in a positive way. It's almost like kind of running a simulation where you're in control of the parameters. Is that similar? Yeah.
Very, very much. It was really interesting to kind of cross the line between some play being therapeutic and engaging in intentionally therapeutic play. So you hear the phrase all the time that, you know, kink is not therapy, but it can be therapeutic. You see it on FetLife forums. You hear it just about any time that people start talking about someone who went through something really significant in a scene. And I wanted to ask the question, could it be therapeutic on purpose? Could it not be a random moment, but an intentional choice to engage in it? So I started thinking about it in the same way that you think about the kind of the evolution of massage. Mm-hmm. Like when I was a kid, nobody went and got a massage and, you know, told anyone about it. And no one would ever say that I'm going to school to be a massage therapist, because people were masseurs, right? You could be a fancy European masseur, or you were a masseuse and you generally worked in a strip mall with a neon sign in your window that said, you know, massage flashing. And it was, you know, generally considered a front for kind of low level prostitution. Mm-hmm. And at some point, someone decided, we're going to take massage and make it a practice. We're going to make it an accepted way for people to get healing. And now you can bill your insurance for going and getting massage. Now, do I think we can get to the point where you can bill your insurance for going and getting kink therapy? I'm going to be bold and say, yeah, I think we can.
We're not there yet.
That would be awesome.
We're not there yet. Yeah. But the American Association for Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, their national conference this year is themed taboo. And they're talking about all of the areas within mental health that have not been talked about for years, because most of the stuff that fall into areas of kink and poly and BDSM and fetish, furry, all of the wide variety of alt sex that we call, and I'm really trying to get away from alt sex because it's just sex, right? It's just sexuality. Yeah. It's who we are.
And the more people you talk to and interact with in the quote unquote alt sex, the more you realize, like, wait a minute, this is just, everyone's like this, you know, in and outside of it. You talk to them and, you know, everyone is experiencing this stuff. They just don't always have the best, you know, place or forum to talk about it with others. And
it's almost like we need to start taking back that word. Instead of saying alt sex, it's just sexuality.
Yeah.
Just taking back that word to incorporate everything from the extreme to the vanilla, everything. It's just sexuality.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why, you know, the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, you don't find any of, you know, bondage, kink, sadomasochism. It's not considered a paraphilia anymore. And a lot of the mental health professionals, they got their education back when it was. Mm-hmm. And that knowledge, that assumption, that set of beliefs has to be updated. And very excitingly, I get to share that we are going to be a Saturday night presentation at the ASECT conference this summer at their national conference, talking about A Kink and the Cure.
Wow, that's very awesome. Exciting.
About how long ago do you think it was that, because I don't know much about the DSM, I know that you worked with it a little bit, about how long ago was it that those things stopped being considered, you know, some sort of diagnosis or something like
that? DSM-5, so DSM-5. Back in 2010 when they republished it.
It's pretty recent. It's not long ago.
Recent.
It's very recent. So when I got my degree back in 07, I was still on the DSM-4.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
And at that time, flogging your partner, and if you admitted to it, you could be institutionalized for having a sexual paraphilia. If they decreed it to be
a lot of our listeners would be in trouble. That'd be a problem. Wow.
And there are just things that take a long time to change. And we've got to give a shout out to organizations like the Woodhull Foundation and the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom, because it's the work that they do. It's having these conversations and the lobbying work that they do that have put the conversation right in the forefront, so that mental health professionals made the change within their own material to reflect what was happening in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, just for our listeners that are curious about going to mental health professionals, I actually go to a therapist myself. And one of the things that I found really nice was I could go on to Denver and search for therapists in the area that deal with polyamory and everything else.
Yeah, it was one of our concerns when we were first looking. Like, we wanted to make sure that we were going to have someone that was addressing, you know, what we would consider to be the things that, you know, we wanted to work on, and not just suddenly, now wait a minute, you two aren't just like, you guys are exploring outside of your relationship and like try to focus on that. Like, we've already worked through that part. I mean, we're not, you know, worked through it entirely, but like, we've already made the decision that that's where we want to go.
Yeah, I wanted a therapist that wasn't going to try pushing me back into the monogamy and everything, because that's not where my life is.
Well, it's
not where the problems are.
That's exactly the thing. Yeah. Is people that ascribe a specific concept as being the problem without looking under the surface.
Yeah. Yeah. They just see like, oh, this is different from, you know, the normal pattern. And that's got to be it. That's the errant behavior, when we might just be maybe a little bit more well-adjusted in that area than even they are.
So what you're saying is we're probably the normal ones.
Well, everyone's normal, right? Like, that's the whole idea.
Well, there's a citation in the book about this, and I should stop calling it a book. It's a play. A Kink and the Cure is a play, and very similar to the Vagina Monologues or Pouring Tea. And there's a conversation in there around the fact that there are now studies around this that are looking at the people that are exploring kink and BDSM, polyamory in their lifestyles. They're really showing to be more mentally stable and generally engaged in more creative, artistic, you know, greater endeavors in their life. And, you know, it's not because they're kinky. It's not because they're poly, but the correlation, you know, corollary data versus causal data, right? Mm-hmm. Is really looking at the fact that you've got people that are looking to color outside the lines. They're willing to say, The status quo does not actually fit me. It doesn't make me happy. So what can I do to change the models that I've been given and find something that works for me, that works for me and my partner, me and my partners? And yeah, that's why I go with the solid model. If it works for you, that's what's the right relationship. There is no right way to do poly. There's no right way to be kinky. There's a right way to be kinky for you and your partner. And that's one of the things that I do in the work, is helping people find where that is.
Now, when you say you help people, what kind of services do you guys offer?
So one of the things I'm trying to start with is working with men in kink, because men are given a lot of really stupid rule sets when they grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, men get told about ways to be seen as dominant, or ways to be seen as being a real man, and it generally gives them a really poor set of skills to enter the world and interact with people. So I do men's work directly on kind of reprogramming what it means to be a man in our society and be happy being a man. And then we also do couples work around engaging in therapeutic kink and helping couples find the right dynamic for them. You know, people will often enter into a kink relationship and then or open their, you know, long-term marriage up to being kink or being poly, and then feel like they're doing it wrong because it's not working for them. But that's because they're trying to make it look just like The Secretary, or they're trying to make it look just like 50 Shades of Grey, or they're trying they read the, you know, Laura Antony's Marketplace books, and they're like, why can't we do this 24/7 master slave daddy girl thing? And it's like, well, because what you're trying to base your life off of is fiction. And like with anything, you can't look at a TV show and say, okay, I'm going to have a life just like that, because they don't show them doing the laundry and dealing with the kids and dealing with the job and the stress and all of those other things.
But I think even outside of like things like TV and books and that sort of thing, stories like that, I think even when you're looking at real examples, the most visible examples are oftentimes the outliers, right? That's not necessarily what is going on with 90% of the population, right? The reason you're seeing it is because already they're in this, you know, perhaps extreme or far end of the spectrum, on whatever spectrum we're talking about. And so for every one person you see like that, there's 10 others that are like maybe a little bit more moderated or somewhere else on that spectrum.
Yeah, but you also don't see all the stuff that's working on underneath the hood. A lot of times, especially when you're seeing other couples or poly groups or anything, and you just see this one big happy family, you're not seeing a lot of the everyday life that, each person
the
goes
work
through.
That goes into it.
Oh, there's a lot of work that goes into a lot of communication. You know, the okay, this doesn't work, there might be hurt feelings, and trying to figure out what works for them, and you're not seeing that.
Yeah,
one of the things I'm curious about when you work with people is how you deal with their fear, because obviously you've got people coming to you who've been through some sort of trauma, or they're really, they've got all of these negative, you know, associations and around some aspect of sex. And what I find fascinating is how you take that from the negative place and you lift that up into a positive thing. How do you go about that and deal with that?
Well, a lot of it is looking at where the fear is founded. And it's like with trying to get over an addiction. If somebody doesn't want to get over their addiction, then there's no amount of therapy that's going to help them do so because they don't want to. You know, my cousin saying, you know, I've been trying to quit smoking for years. Oh, why haven't you quit? Well, do you want to stop smoking? No, not really. Well, that's why you're not getting, quitting isn't successful, because you don't actually want to quit. So getting people to answer that question honestly of what it is that they want out of a situation versus I'm afraid of this thing. Okay. If there's a fear there, what is it you want to be able to do? Let's get to the other side of the activity you want to be able to engage in. And we were talking about this earlier around diet. If you talk about things that you can't eat, then all you end up doing is thinking about the things that you can't eat, as opposed to focusing on the things that you can eat and looking for the things within that that you like, and then focusing on, okay, I'm going to eat a lot of these things that I really like. And so I kind of approach it the same way.
I love that approach, actually.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, you can still pry those tomatoes and onions from my cold, dead hands.
So there was this young woman who wanted to do a scene, and she wanted to kind of really get back in touch with her emotions. And I don't know that anyone that met her would have said that she wasn't emotive, but she knew that there was something deeper that she wasn't tapping into. And she wanted to do some rather deep play. And now before we went there, I decided to work with her and start on something simpler. So I was just going to see if I could get her to that edge, find where her edge was. Because, you know, when you're talking about edge play, for each person, it's going to be different. For some people, it's going to be tickling. And they're just like, oh, fuck no. No tickling. Don't you tickle me.
Or,
right? Yeah. Yeah. Balloon popping. And finding where that edge is. And she didn't really know where hers was. And it's not from pain, because I've seen her, you know, just have the snot beat out of her. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be able to do that for her. So what can I do? So she had told me that she no electricity play was allowed, and that she had been hit with a cattle prod when she was younger. And it's a big no, and she doesn't have any desire to overcome that, right? Why fix that, right? Be like I'm afraid of taking heroin. Okay, that's fine. You can keep that fear. There's no reason. We don't need to fix that fear. So we did the scene, and we're having fun, and she's on the rack, and we're having a good time. But I'm clear that I'm not breaking any new ground with her. We're not doing anything spectacular. So I reach into my bag and I pull out a cattle prod, and she's chained to the rack. She can't get away, right? And I walk over towards her, and her eyes go big as saucers, and like I'm about to violate her boundaries, and right, just totally reinforce and re-traumatize everything. And I unhook her hand and I hand her the cattle prod. Now she's holding it. So we haven't engaged in any electrical play. I haven't violated anything. I've just put a piece of equipment in her hand. But now when I go back and we start going back into the flogging, we do the rest of it, her mind is now in the scene. Her emotions are present. She isn't able to disassociate because she's holding this cattle prod in her hand.
It's like a wake-up call. Ooh.
Yeah. And so at the end of that,
goosebumps.
You know, I don't know if cattle prod is probably definitely a hard limit for me, but even not, like, you put that in my hand, I've been like, whew. I'm paying attention now.
Yeah, exactly. You're paying attention now, and that's what happened, is that sometimes we get really skilled at hiding from ourselves, at turning off our emotions in various situations, and this work is really about helping people find the holes in that armor, stepping into it. And then holding them safely within that, recognizing that, helping them learn that it's okay for someone to get inside of that armor, mm-hmm. and hold them in that really vulnerable space, and that they're okay at the end of the day.
Yeah, that just hearing you talk about that kind of, you know, scene and everything, it just reminds me so much of that one scene we saw back at Camp Crucible back in D.C. We went to the big 2-week King Cavett back out there. And one of the first nights, it was basically jumping into deep end with both your feet.
We had only just like kind of found BDSM outside of just like, you know, oh, let me, you know, handcuffs and fuzzy handcuffs, that sort of thing. When we actually like, you know, went started understanding what it was and went to an event. And then like the next thing we did is go to Camp Crucible.
That's a good way to step up.
Zero to 6,000.
But I do remember this one scene where this, it was probably the most amazing scene I've ever seen in my life. And there was this female that had hooks were being placed in her back. And it was a good hour lead up to the, like, the actual scene itself. And, well, I mean, the whole thing was a scene, but the climax of it. And, you know, her partner was, and I think it was like her leather daddy or something, was also telling her all these things. Like, apparently she'd gone through so much trauma in her life and she wanted to fly. So what they did when they got to this climax is just had her fly.
And as in hanging from the hooks.
As in hanging from the hooks. And she just the emotional release after that.
Yeah.
It, when you were talking about, you know, therapeutic, that's what really resonates with me is a lot of these scenes can be therapeutic. I've gone through that myself where after a really good, hard scene, I'm just sitting there sobbing and just all this stuff comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think you're really onto something with that that needs to be talked about.
Thank you.
It seems to me then that these therapies are helpful for not just like traumatic sexual things, but any kind of traumatic thing you might have had, like the catharsis that you're going through might be helpful for other areas in your life. Like, have you seen a lot of that happen, Tim?
I worked with my partner on her phobia of rodents.
Oh, really?
The kink scene. Yeah. So we negotiated with the play space that it was going to be okay for us to bring in these pets. So they were a friend of mine who had some pet rats. And I tied her up on an autopsy table. An autopsy table is built so that the body can be elevated off of the table so that when they're working on it, there's all this room for the drainage, which is kind of gross, but really good for this particular scene because that left room underneath her
for all the rats.
For the mice to.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh,
and
God.
And I covered her in a sheet and so that she couldn't see anything, and then pulled the mice out and had them crawling over the top of the sheet.
Oh, man.
So she could keep telling herself that it was just us pretending that they were rats. And then I pulled the sheet up over her feet so that her feet were exposed. And then I moved the sheet up over her knees and let them crawl over her calves. And we slowly moved the sheet up until the sheet was just covering her face. And you know, she's talking to herself through all of this. And then, you know, we take the sheet off of her face and I put Fruit Loops on her eyelids so that the rats came up.
Oh, my God.
Now, these are pet rats, right? There's nothing dangerous that's happening here. Sure. Yeah. This is kind of like Chris Hatfield's conversation about the difference between danger and fear. Because she was never in any danger. These are not anything that are ever going to bite her. And yet she's trusting me to make sure that whatever is happening, she is safe, even if I'm walking her through this major phobia of hers. And you know, then at a certain point, she opens her eyes and there's a rat sitting on her chest eating Fruit Loop that it had just pulled off of her eyelid. And does she still have a phobia of rodents? Yes. For years after that scene, it was less because...
Yeah.
When you're then faced with another rodent issue, you're like, oh, yeah, those might still be scary, but I'm not naked and they're crawling all over me. Like I've got a comparison now that this is really like not that big of a deal.
Yeah. It's not sitting on my breast eating breakfast.
And we can talk about that and laugh and it be a fun experience as opposed to, right, I had this horrible, you know, experience with rodents that kind of ingrained this phobia. So again, it's creating experiences for people that allow them to have different data points to refer back to.
Right. Now, Max, don't get any ideas with spiders than me on this.
I don't think there's any reason to cure your spider phobia. I think that's perfectly, you know, we can leave that one be.
I'm okay with
that. Hey, Lily?
Yeah?
Say oops.
Oops.
Because now I know your spider phobia.
Oh, I'm trying to think what we would cure for me. I mean, the biggest fear I have in the world, I mean, besides like the obvious, besides obvious, like losing the ones I love, like we're talking about more tangible things, right? Like, would probably be driving. I hate driving. Clowns are pretty high, but you know,
you don't run into them that often.
You don't run into them that often.
I suffer from calorophobia as well.
Spiders.
That's
the fear of clowns.
No kidding.
I had mine. Mine was reduced dramatically by a friend who showed up at my birthday party, which was a carnival-themed birthday party, as like a classic Red Skelton horror clown, like the nose, the hair, the oversized pants. And she had her hands stuffed down the front of her pants and chased me around the party all night, going, I got a kiss for you. I got a kiss for you. With her hands down her pants. And then she'd pull out Hershey Kisses out of her pants. So for me, then every other clown that I ran into after that, I was like, you got nothing. Yeah. You might still be a clown, and I might still want to punch you in the face, but they don't scare me the way that they scare me.
Oh, gosh, I know. Obvious. Needles.
Oh, yeah. Duh. Max has a terrifying fear of needles.
Oh, God. You're
to where he actually,
face,
poor Max, passed
out. I broke my nose.
He broke his nose when he was a kid.
Yeah. They're like, oh, you're due for your tetanus shot.
But then again, you've gotten over your fear a little bit where I'm passing out at the sight of needles.
Yeah, somehow you caught that. I don't know. Needles didn't bother her before, but I think because she's had to like be there so many times, like hold my hand and like watch me like and turn white as a sheet and pass out. Like now it's like a negative experience.
That empathic
for her.
Connection. You're like trying to take it on board. Yeah.
Especially
and now she's worse than me though, because I was able. The last time we got our STD tests, like I didn't actually pass out. I didn't do anything. Like you know, had the blood drawn, no problem. And you,
I passed out.
It was a big deal. Yeah.
But I think it's because I worked myself up because I don't like getting blood drawn.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say no one does. I'm like, no, wait.
Lots of people do.
I'm saying that.
Trust me, if it exists in the world or not exists, there's a fetish for it. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to clear up a piece because it plays into both the title of the play and kind of the conversation which we're having is that a kink in the cure, meaning that this is a piece of people treating their trauma or their fears. It's not the cure. Kink isn't the cure, but it can be a part of the cure for people. That the work that I do, if I'm working with someone, like playing with someone is different, but if I'm working with someone, they have to have a pre-existing relationship with a therapist. This is not a replacement for therapy. It's an augment in the same way that working with a horse for equine therapy is not a replacement for talking to a person in order to process the emotions that come up after you've done the work.
What if the therapist is a pony player dressed as a horse? Can you do like 2-in-1 go?
You know, I haven't tried that yet. But these are the trisexuals, right? I'm open to try it. So, you know, we could see how that works. That's the fun thing about the evolution of the community is that as more kinksters are moving into the mental health field, you're having people that are, you know, coming out of with their degree being therapists who are kinky themselves, not just kink friendly therapists, but kinky therapists who aren't going to play with you, but they are going to get what it is that you're talking about on an entirely different level. And maybe they are pony players on the weekend. Yeah. And who knows, in another couple of years, you might be able to go do equine therapy with a, you know, doing pony play.
Almost certainly there is a therapist out there, at least one that is, you know, a pony player on the weekend.
The odds are
many more that haven't discovered it yet.
Yeah.
You know, so like, and as we do this stuff, you know, more and more people are going to feel comfortable, you know, talking about it and making it known, because there's not a section of life or particular type of person that a kink person is, like you were saying. It's everywhere. Sorry, folks, you can't escape. we're all over the place.
Yeah, in my experience, I would say it's the odds are probably much better that it's that a person is kinky than they are what we would call vanilla.
Yeah,
because how you define kink determines that. And for a lot of people, you know, pulling hair, being held down, counts as kinky,
yeah.
right? And I don't know anybody myself who doesn't like a little bit of that somewhere.
Absolutely.
Even the people that would call themselves vanilla.
Simple math, it's one. Vanilla is like one thing, right? And then there's infinity. So, like, you know, like one versus infinity. What's going to win out?
And that actually brought me into thinking, you're also a puppy player,
yes.
right?
Yes, I am. That was probably my first, like, real exploration into the kink community back in Seattle was really showing up at a Halloween party where I didn't know anybody. I had met almost no one at the scene, woman that I were dating, and I decided to go as Dorothy and Toto. And she got all Dorothied up, and I showed up at the club and got naked, had a tail in my ass, and walked around on all fours and didn't speak to anybody. I was absolutely nonverbal puppy the entire night.
Wow, that sounds like my ideal way to do a party, yeah. period.
It was an absolutely marvelous way to get to meet people because yeah. people just thought it was adorable and I didn't have to talk to them at all.
Yeah. Well, dogs are always the life of the party and they don't have to say anything. It's perfect.
I just curled up at the DJ's feet. It was a very, very happy place to spend the evening.
That sounds perfect, actually. It's adorable.
What I wanted to know more about, because I was looking into the services you offer, and my eyes immediately got drawn to the board games. So I believe, what is that one called? Oh yeah, Playing in Your Relationship. I'd like to know a little bit more about that.
So have you ever gotten in an argument with your partner while you're playing a board game because they're doing things that annoy you? And it becomes this little microcosm of a relationship. Yes.
Yeah, and so
all I can think of is Ticket to Ride.
Everybody's got a story. Everybody's got a story. We can't play that game anymore. Risk is not allowed in our house, or this game is not allowed in our house because of a fight that
Risk's
happens.
Not that good of a game. Anymore,
right.
So.
Anyway,
continue. So by taking the ideas behind gamification and gamification, when it's used in this corporate sense, tends to get, you know, all focused on like points and badges and leaderboards. But when you look at game design, it really is about behavioral psychology. Why people do anything is encapsulated in games. I'm motioning to the, you know,
hundred
or so board games that are sitting here in this room.
If there's a small earthquake where we're recording right now, we would be happily buried
in
dead
board games
under a ton of board games. At least six of them, Catan, I think.
So I take the ideas behind gamification and behavioral motivation, motivational science, and conflict resolution, and I squash it all together. And I say, if the two of you are like wanting to work through something, you've got a conflict that's going on in your life, and you've been trying to talk about it, right? You're not, you know, just mad at each other, but you're aware that there's a conflict around something. Let's see if we can figure it out. So I will literally just, we'll sit down, we'll play a game. Oh. And in playing the game, I will be watching how it is that you choose to communicate with each other about what's happening within the game. Because what happens is that your guard gets let down. You start playing the game, you communicate in default fashion as opposed to communicating as in front of therapist fashion. And absolutely. I get to see how you're actually interacting. And then by using that as a microcosm to then say, okay, it's curious that on this opportunity to make this trade with Lily, you chose not to do it, but there wasn't actually a gain there for you. What was behind that? Like, what was the reason that you did that? And did you even notice that you chose not to make that choice to support someone that could be there? And Lily, you rejected an offer that was made, right? And so we can see where these things happen, where these default behaviors that are in our relationship start coming up even in game. And then you can start looking for that in an easier way in real life.
So there's certain go-to board games that are good for this sort of activity, or you have like a list of ones and you pick the one that's right for what you think might be a good direction to go down?
Yeah, so Flux is a really great microcosm for talking about change, like a change in life when people are having trouble adjusting to a move or something, you know, job change has happened in life, or, you know, any, as Massey would call them, you know, C's, significant emotional events that have occurred. You start playing Flux and you start looking at how does this person respond to rapid change that's being forced upon them. Catan is one of my favorite games for looking at communication and engagement because there's no money involved and the game is built to encourage communication. Pandemic is another great example of a cooperative game that can be played independently, or it can be played very collaboratively, and how do individuals choose to communicate about their role in the game? Do they play with their hands just on the table, or are they holding their cards? Are they asking each other questions, or are they telling what you should do on your turn? Right? Am I saying, oh no, you should take this move and that move and this move, so you can then move that one and this one, which is pretty much me playing the whole game for you all by ourselves. I'm just telling you what you should do.
And friends like that.
We definitely have friends that do that. Yeah.
And that difference tells you a lot about their communication and their style. So.
And if you want to destroy a relationship, you bring out Monopoly.
No. If you want to destroy a relationship, you bring out Diplomacy.
Oh, yeah.
Diplomacy is a relationship-ending game.
I have to say, on the subject of board games, we actually did get a chance to play Monopoly using the actual
rules.
And it was not that bad.
It was pretty good. So what's fun about Monopoly, a little known fact, is that it was actually designed in order to show why capitalism doesn't work.
The landlord's game.
Yeah. It's a game designed to be bad and to show you why capitalism is broken.
And then what people do when they take the game is they put in a bunch of public programs that keep it actually running longer than it.
They make it communist.
they do. You know, the money on free parking.
There's not just that. They also have things where, oh, well, Susie always gets this one and Jeffrey always gets this one and always do it that way.
Yeah, Bob always takes the railroads.
Right? Yeah.
But you can't choose because you land on them and you get.
Yeah.
It's dice. There's no choice in Monopoly.
It's all chance.
That's awesome. You were talking a bit about this before, but I'm actually curious to learn a little bit more if you have more to say on it. One of the other services you offer, I think it's called Building a Better Man. And so you were talking about just tell us more about it. I need to know more.
I'm happy to. I want to acknowledge, Kit, it sounded like I didn't know if there was a question.
No, I think you've answered my question as we went along, so we're good there. I'm actually really interested in what you have to say about Max's question, too, because I think a lot of times there isn't as much focus on helping men and recognition that men have difficulties with some of these things about perceptions about them and sexuality stuff too. And I think that's really nice that you have a program to help them. So I'm really curious to hear what you have to say here.
I want to change the default roles that men are put into within both the kink community and just in society in general, that you know, men in general are told that they pretty much get to experience, you know, a very small number of emotions. You get to be mad. You get to have, you know, lust and want, and you get to experience success, not joy or happiness, but success. It's okay to be successful, but being happy is not, it's kind of, you know, a little too touchy-feely, right? And in order for us to have a culture that doesn't breed men to be repressed and not be able to express themselves, and then have women who are then, or men, for that matter, have partners who are then criticizing them for not being emotive enough. And then when they're emotive, saying, oh, why aren't you being more manly? And this recursive self-destructive cycle where you can't win, right? If you're a man who's not big and tough and strong, then you're too much of a sissy. And if you're too big and tough and strong, then you're not sensitive enough and you're not listening. But if you listen to, right, it just goes back and forth. There isn't a winning on either side of that equation. And so in order to change that conversation, we have to start changing the way not just society thinks about men, but the way men think about themselves and encourage other men to be better men. That's not about me just working with men. It's about creating a change in the larger conversation so that, you know, Max and I, when we see men doing things that we don't want to be associated with men, we don't just walk away and say, oh, I'm not that guy and I'm not going to associate with those guys.
Yeah.
But we have conversations with them to help build better men overall.
Now, Tim, do you have an example of where you've helped men be better men?
So the conversation comes around from working through the work I did with Kitsy and coming across a young woman who wanted to get into the kink community, and she wanted to work with a male dominant, and our age gap was pretty significant. And I wanted to find someone that was closer to her age to be able to do work with. So I called around to a couple of dominatrices that I know, pro-doms, and said, this is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for someone somewhere between, about 20, 30 years old that, that you would trust with an 18-year-old woman who identifies as submissive and wants to get into the scene and wants to work with a male dominant. Who would you recommend? And it was crickets. I got no responses.
Wow.
So you were looking for a male dom of around that age to
work with an 18-year-old woman.
Yeah.
And when I asked professional women who work in the kink community,
yeah,
I got no response. Like, they didn't talk to me. I got responses that said, I don't know anyone that fits that bill that they would trust with an 18-year-old submissive woman entering the scene.
So was it that they knew male, they knew male dominants, but that not ones that they would trust with this particular situation?
Correct. There's lots of male dominants. I can find lots of male dominants. Right, I don't have a problem with that. But someone that that you could trust in that situation to handle a person and make sure that they're not going to re-traumatize them, they're not going to do something negative, that they're not going to take advantage of this person's naivety. And I couldn't get a name.
Yeah, that's not a good sign.
And the fact that happened, I was like, oh, okay, there's a problem here. There's a dearth of people that I would just comfortably say, oh yeah, I know someone that fits in that category. And so I started asking myself, why is that? What are the qualities that I'm looking for within people that would be missing? And what do I need to start doing just on a personal level to start helping people that I know fit that bill? So we started having conversations. We started saying, okay, if I know someone who's really good at these things, but I don't think that they really quite get the enthusiastic consent conversation, we're going to start having that conversation, that uncomfortable conversation. Even when it's uncomfortable for a guy to be having a conversation with another guy about establishing enthusiastic consent at a party, right? So now I go to a play party and I see a guy who's engaging in play that's a little bit assumptive, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're stepping in.
So it almost seems like this isn't about, an individual. It seems like you're almost changing kind of like the whole way that the male is handled in the kink community, right? Like,
that's correct.
It's not about, you make a change to one, it's not going to matter as much, but about making it kind of the norm or making it okay.
It's both.
Yeah.
It's both. So I'm a big believer in the starfish philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. You make a difference for each one, right? That making a difference for one makes a difference for all.
Okay.
And that's a starfish story. You can just Google that.
I know the starfish story.
Right? I'm working at the center in Seattle, and this guy joins the club, and conversation that I know that we've had before is that the kink community often attracts peoples that are on the autistic Asperger's spectrum because there's structure, there's rules for social engagement, right? So it's very appealing. And this guy joins and he's standing in the club and he's in trying to talk to people and he's trying to follow the rules, but he's socially awkward and he's making people uncomfortable and he's not getting any dates and there's nobody that's connected around him and then because of that he's trying harder, but his version of trying harder makes people more uncomfortable and it's just not working.
Yeah.
And I started talking to him and I said, okay, let's start engaging in some different things. Let's choose some behaviors that you can engage in safely that meet both people's needs for space and your desire for structure. And so helping that person find ways to engage with people that can say, walk up and say, hi, you look really beautiful tonight. Would it be okay if I rubbed your feet? And teaching that guy how to accept rejection, that when she says, no, not tonight, it's not personal. It's not about him. It actually has nothing to do with him. Whatever is going on for her is her situation and it's not him. And he can go talk to somebody else. And if she's interested, she now knows that he's interested. She can come back later when you've shown that you know how to take rejection. And what happened was, that's exactly what happened. He was able to do that. And then people started inviting him into things. And he started volunteering for the organization because that's how you show that you're connected.
I could probably use your help too. I've not had a lot of luck going into the BDSM scene, probably for similar reasons.
there's rules here, and that's why some people don't, because they'd rather go to the club where they can just randomly grind on people without having to ask for permission. Quote, having to ask for permission, right? But they should be.
Yeah.
If I'm going into a club, I still should, I'd like to dance with you, as opposed to just automatically grinding up on somebody. So the work is both this larger context conversation and the individual work. And so the service is for men who know that they fit into that category. They're like, you know what, I know that there are times when I go to parties and I create these socially awkward situations, and I would like to change that, because it's not about being bad. It's not about doing something wrong. It's about learning new ways of interacting. And I, using men versus women, I know I don't really fall in the, you know, one solid side of that category, but, you know, as a visibly identified male, even if my internal clock kind of bounces back and forth, it's an important conversation to have on that side of the fence.
I think you've definitely hit the nail on that one, because I know I've tried to help Max, you know, when we've gone to BDSM things and I get all these offers and stuff and he didn't get any, you know, for play partners, and he would go to have those conversations. And even though what works for me, it won't work for him.
Well, the other part about that is, and we've talked about this before, but I'm autistic, and the way that I oftentimes cope with that is I look for someone similar to me, or, you know, fits similar parameters, and I try to you know, replicate what they're doing. You know, I see what everyone's doing, I try to like fit into that. But in BDSM, I never really found guys that were actually doing the stuff that I was interested in. So I had like nothing to go on. I was totally just untethered.
Which is awesome.
It is.
I mean, there's good potential. The thing that you just said there that I absolutely love is that you couldn't find any guys that were into the things that you're into, which means you are a guy who is into something that you don't see any other men being, which all of a sudden makes you the guy that people can go to for the things that you're interested in. And as soon as you can start seeing it that way, then you are a beacon for all of the people, men, women, whatever you're trying to attract, that are interested in that thing, because you're not seeing anyone out there. And we get stuck in this. If I don't see anyone out there that's doing it, it either
I just assumed I didn't belong.
Right. It either A, must not be wanted, or B, there must be something wrong with doing that, because otherwise someone else would be doing it. But that's not the case.
That's exactly how I felt.
I went to Thunder in the Mountains with a bag full of balloon animal balloons, and I put a balloon corset on a woman, and I've never seen anybody do this before. And then I put her up against a rack and I used a single tail and I whipped them off of her. Now
that's awesome.
Okay, there's really no model for me to be able to do that. Yeah. I had to accept that a person said they want that, and I'm going to trust this person that they actually want it, and I'm going to do it. And there's no way I can do it wrong, because there's no way to do it right. There's no example for me to do it right. I'm going to work with this person, and we're going to figure out what works for us. And we went and did it.
Inspiration. I love that. The balloon animals thing. That's great. I mean, if I would have seen that, I would have felt like, oh, there's someone that's into crazy stuff like me. That's helpful. I did the one year we saw, there was a couple running around looking for someone to be their croquet ball, right? They had like the whole croquet mallets and stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah. They're like, hey, will you be our croquet ball? They just wanted to like hit a submissive around. It was really great. I love goofy stuff like that. And of course, our favorite, which we've talked about on the show before, the person that dresses up like a squirrel to play with all the pups.
That was drives them crazy. Love that.
Squirrel.
I just want to say I'm really impressed by your positive approach and positive way of framing things, because I think sometimes people tend to get too focused on why am I a victim, what is wrong, rather than, you know, how do I look at this in a healthier way? And you just keep coming back to that over and over, and I love that approach so much. So I can see why you're successful. So that's all. I just think that's really cool.
It will continue to gain more success.
Yes, absolutely.
So if you're in the Denver area, we're doing a show at Blush and Blue down in Denver on the 17th of February. There are limited tickets, so hop online. You can find the link through our Facebook page or our website at kinkinthecure.com. And then also, if you're in the mental health field, we're going to be at the ASECT conference here coming up in June, which is also being held here in Denver. And we'll be the Saturday night show for doing the full performance of A Kink in the Cure there.
And awesome. All for our listeners, all this will be in the show notes at the bottom.
In the show notes. Please follow and reach out to them. And what is the best way, if somebody's interested in one of these services, what's the best way for them to reach out to you? Just go to the...
Go to the website, and we've got contact information there. There's also a place there to request readings. We do readings at colleges and universities, at community centers, kink events. So if you've got an event that you'd like to have us come do a performance of A Kink in the Cure, which is... The research that I've done around this compiled into about a 70 to 90 minute play that is built of multiple testimonials of how different people used kink and BDSM to treat, either successfully or unsuccessfully, treat sexual shame and trauma. This is the piece that we close the show with. I wrote a little Dr. Seuss parody called Oh, the Places You'll Come, and I wanted to share it with you today. Sex can be scary. Sex can be fun. Sex can be hurtful. Sex can be won. I win! I win! Sex can be had on top of a boat, or just in your socks, or deep in your throat. Wherever your sexual interests may lay, make sure there's consent, and then you're okay. Because sometimes there's darkness. Because sometimes there is. Because of her misunderstanding or his. Because maybe he just didn't listen at all, or maybe she's just too afraid and feels small. Whatever the reason, she's hurt and she's broke. His ego is shattered. He thinks he's a joke. Sex is now scary and hurtful and hard. The fun has been smothered and burned out and scarred. So what to do next? It's all icky and scary. Let's turn to the kinksters, the scary sex fairies. The ones who make dark into giggles and fun. The ones who can smother with passion and love. They'll tie you up good and they'll make you moan. You'll see that though hurting, you're never alone. They'll hold you while crying. They'll make hurtful fun. You'll like sex again before they are done. Except when they don't. Because sometimes they won't. Sometimes they haven't a clue what to do, and the things that they try just make more mess, it's true. But you keep keeping on. You'll find your way through. You'll find that right mix, and you'll hum a new tune. A tune full of orgasm, all happy and gay. You'll own your own pleasure. It can happen today. Thank you.
Aww. Look forward to your cocks and socks. Fox with cocks and socks rendition. That's awesome.
Oh my goodness, I loved it.
Thank you, Tim, for being on our show. I'm really hoping that the Trisexuals and Kink and the Cure can work on stuff together in the future. I really love your vision. I think that there's a lot of great things that we can end up doing together. What do you guys think? Was that a good time or what?
Absolutely.
It was a positively sexy experience.
Yeah, we did get to hang out. Well, unfortunately, you know, because Kit records remote, she didn't get to join, so we did get to hang out in the hot tub afterwards and kind of relax. And I kind of think that the after podcast hot tub dip should be something we do normally.
I think it's a requirement.
It's a requirement. Yeah, definitely have to do that. Well, guys, it's just about all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Trisexuals Podcast. I'm Max Chameleon, the Yolkster.
I'm Lily, the Excellent Chameleon.
And I'm Kit, reminding you to not just be sex positive, but to be sex over positive.
Thanks for listening, guys. We love
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Bye.
Put those eggs in your butt, butt, eggs in your butt, butt, eggs in your butt, butt, eggs in your butt.